I'm just going to be talking about Operation Backfire. If people want more information about other Green Scare stuff, check out sites like Support Eric, Support Rod. Yeah, definitely educate yourself. So, a year and 2 days ago, on December 7th, 2005, there were seven people arrested in four different cities across the U.S. Let me see, they were Chelsea Gerlach, Darren Thurston, William Rogers, Kendall Tankersley, Kevin Tubbs, Daniel McGowan, and Stan Meyerhoff. And they were all accused of different actions, most of which were claimed under the banners of the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. It was targeted sabotage against things like meat and lumber companies, enterprises linked to genetic engineering. In all of these actions, there wasn't a single injury to either animal or human life. At the same time, the Attorney General did get up in front of the media and said, these people are the number one domestic terrorist threat, which really says something about how this society considers crimes against property to be the ultimate evil. So on the same day as those initial arrests took place, there were also a series of grand jury subpoenas calling people in the Pacific Northwest before a Eugene, Oregon grand jury. Within a few days of those first arrests, it also became evident that one person, Jake Ferguson, he was revealed as a paid informant in these cases. Also, almost as soon as he was arrested, Stanislaus Meyerhoff did begin informing on others. The act of these informants had really tragic consequences. On the night of December 21st to December 22nd, William Rogers, one of the accused, took his life in his jail cell in Arizona. I'm going to read you very quickly the note attributed to him on the night of his death. To my friends and supporters, to help them make sense of all these events that have happened so quickly, certain human cultures have been waging war against the Earth for millennia. I choose to fight on the side of bears, mountain lions, skunks, bats, saguaros, cliferos, and all things wild. I'm just the most recent casualty in that war, but tonight I've made a jailbreak. I'm returning home to the Earth and to the place of my origins. Bill, December 21st, 2005, the winter solstice. On January the 20th, federal prosecutors and the U.S. Attorney General announced a 65-count indictment against 11 individuals, and the charges related to 17 different incidents of sabotage in Oregon, Washington, and California. This indictment charged various individuals with arson, attempted arson, and perhaps most importantly, using and carrying a destructive device. That charge has a mandatory minimum sentence of, 30 years for the first conviction, and then life for afterwards. So obviously the use of these mandatory minimums as a threat had a huge impact on the way defendants were intimidated and the way these cases played out. In fact, it soon became clear that there were five individuals who were operating as confidential sources for the government. And because of this informing, on February 22nd, Nathan Block and Joanna Zacher were arrested in the community of Olympia, Washington. There was a new indictment on March 15th that added various charges and added Nathan and Joanna. Yeah. There were a long series, actually, of subsequent re-indictments, which I'm not going to go into in that much detail. I will say, at this time as well, a series of people were indicted for the Vail, Colorado ski resort arson as well. Let me see. So on July the 20th and 21st, six people pled guilty to a variety of charges. These people were Darren Thurston, Kevin Tubbs, Kendall Tankersley, Stan Meyerhoff, Chelsea Gerlach, and Suzanne Savoy. And I'm sorry, I should back up really quickly that in this time as well, Jonathan Pohl had been added to the indictment, Susan Savoy had been, and also Joseph Deby, Rebecca Rubin, Josephine O'Breaker were also added. These last individuals are believed to be out of the country. Let me see. So these six people, they pled guilty to a variety of conspiracy, attempted arson charges. They also agreed to fully and completely cooperate with the authorities. And as a result of this cooperation, they received massively reduced suggested sentences. So Tubbs got a suggested sentence of 168 months, Tankersley, 51 months, Meyerhoff, 188 months, Gerlach, 120 months, and Savoy, 63 months. Let me see, during this time as well, the government announced that it was going to try and add a terrorism enhancement at sentencing, which would, as well as adding up to 20 years of time. Also, these people will be coming out of prison. They'll have the stigma of being a terrorist attached to them forever, probably never be able to leave the country, do basic things like open up a bank account and so forth. Let me see. So on November 9th, the remaining District of Oregon defendants, Joanna Zucker, Nathan Block, Daniel McGowan, and Jonathan Pohl, they also entered plea deals, but in radically different circumstances. In this situation, it was what's called a global resolution deal. Just before this happened, the attorneys for these defendants, they dropped a motion to obtain possible National Security Agency wiretap discovery materials. And as a result of those being dropped, and as a result of the global resolution of these District of Oregon federal cases, Nathan, Joanna, Jonathan Pohl, Daniel, they were all able to make some deal where they accepted responsibility for their own actions, but they said they were completely not offering any information, any testimony against anyone else. These defendants, because they refused to collaborate with the state in that way, in terms of offering testimony and information, they got slightly higher sentences than the people who had taken the plea deals before. Let me see. So, let me see. Joanna, Nathan, and Daniel McGowan all received suggested sentences of 96 months, and Jonathan Pohl received a suggested sentence of 60 months. On December 14th, in the federal court in Oregon, there's going to be some hearings about when the actual formal sentencing takes place. Again, these people are also, the government's trying to add this terrorist jacket onto them. This could have real-world consequences beyond sentencing departures that give them a greater sentence than what was suggested. So that remains to be seen. I should also mention, this is in District of Oregon. In Washington federal court, Breonna Waters is still going to trial. She asserts her innocence on all counts. She's being accused of taking part in an arson at the University of Washington. Going to trial, there's been a couple of people also took informant plea deals in regards to Washington federal charges. I think that's pretty much where we're at right now. Let me see. I mentioned earlier that the government has used the grand juries continually throughout these Operation Backfire prosecutions. Unfortunately, this has genuinely intimidated a lot of people. Let me see. I'm going to introduce one person who was called before a federal grand jury in Eugene, Oregon, and who stuck by his principles, and as a result, spent almost half a year in jail. So I'd like to introduce Jeff Hogue. Thank you.
Thanks for coming, everybody. I'd like to add about the Green Scare, just some interesting statistics that kind of show that the federal government's misguided crime priorities. You know, like we've heard that about 2 years ago, the FBI announced that the ELF and the ALF are the number one domestic terrorism threat in the country, and they get all this federal funding to go out and harass and intimidate activist communities by saying that, but they're not really interested in protecting communities from violent crimes, from crimes that terrorize human beings. Some things that indicate that are their own statistics. In 2003, there were 7,400 hate crimes motivated by race, ethnic, religion, sex, and gender. And in that same year, there was also 450 environmental crimes by corporations, industries, and violating the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, hazardous waste dumping, you name it. So they have some pretty skewed priorities, and they're just using the whole terrorism thing to play off our fears in the post 9/11 era. But that's not really what I want to talk about. I want to just share my experience about grand juries and just talk about grand juries in general. I'm sure lots of you have been educated about them to a certain extent, but I'm still going to go through like the basic stuff. I guess I'll just start off by saying, in case you haven't heard the basics of my story, I refused to testify to the federal grand jury in Eugene. Back in May, and I was put in jail for 6 months, and this grand jury was supposedly investigating the ELF arsons. As a result, let's see. So I'm just going to talk about grand juries in general and then kind of get into more specifics of my story. Grand juries have pretty much unlimited investigative power, unlike regular law enforcement investigation. There have been a few grand juries in Eugene thought to be looking into the crimes of property damage over the years. Various people have been subpoenaed. A few have chosen not to cooperate as their path, and luckily were not jailed. Others have testified thinking that they had no information about crimes, so why not, you know? I don't want to risk going to jail, but they thought they were talking about seemingly unimportant things, but really they're giving the feds information about the activist community that likely helped them in their campaign of harassment and intimidation, that probably helped them decide who to illegally wiretap, who to subpoena next time they want to. like what they were doing up here last year about this time. Although grand juries are supposed to be investigating crimes and issuing indictments, they have historically been used as a tool in a larger campaign of harassment, surveillance, and destabilization of movements. This divide and conquer strategy has been used against the labor movement, civil rights movement, anti-war movement, Puerto Rican independence movement, Black Panthers, to name a few. In the Green Scare, between 60 and 100 people have been subpoenaed since 2000. We're not clear how many because you never really know what exactly they were subpoenaing them about. But the vast majority of them were innocent law-abiding citizens called in to talk about friends, neighbors, and coworkers. This violation of First Amendment rights of free speech and association is one of the many abuses of the grand jury system. Grand juries are not entitled to ask for records of membership, how money in organizations is being used, who your friends are, who you associate with, who attends meetings. I'm sure you all know this, but I just want to reaffirm that because sometimes people forget these things when they get in front of the man. And there have been people who talked about who went to like a volunteer work party at like the Earth First Journal, for example. And they totally didn't need to say that. They could have gone and talked to their lawyer and figured out that they didn't have to say that. But anyways, of the people thought to be subpoenaed in the Green Scare, of all those people, only one was not considered a target. They can pretty much subpoena anyone without coming up with proof that they really have anything to do with what they're investigating. So it's kind of weird. If you get hauled in by the cops and they want to ask you questions, you can use your right to remain silent. But you can't do that in front of a grand jury. That's another way that their unlimited investigative powers are used, by taking away your Fifth Amendment rights to remain silent. In a normal trial, a witness could plead the Fifth, but in a grand jury, if you plead the Fifth, they can give you immunity, forcing you to testify or face contempt charges, which is what happened to me. In stark contrast to an interrogation, like I said, where you never have to answer questions, or search or arrest warrants, the government has to have a probable cause, but anyways. So grand juries are secretive. They're controlled by government prosecutors. There's no judge present. There's about 23 jurors, and oftentimes they don't do anything. They just sit there and listen. They can ask questions, and they actually have the power to drop your subpoena and do a bunch of other things, but they usually don't know about that. The jurors listen to only the evidence that the government prosecutor chooses to present. If there's probable cause to believe a person has committed an offense, then they issue an indictment. A judge in New York has a sort of famous quote that says something to the effect of, you can indict a ham sandwich. I don't know if you guys have heard that before, but the Republicans were really fond of using that when they were trying to defend Tom DeLay when he was being indicted for his corruption. And that just kind of goes to show how they all really know that you can totally manipulate grand juries to do what you want and indict people pretty easily. But the justification for them in our Constitution is to protect the people from prosecutors run rampant. And abuse of government power. Interesting. But obviously the grand jury system does not work if it's so easy to manipulate. So like I said, there's no judge. You also do not have the right to an attorney when you're in that room. That's a Sixth Amendment right that is taken away from you for the grand jury process. You can step out of the grand jury room and go consult your attorney in the hallway. It's kind of weird. And I guess you're supposed to remember what they asked you word for word and go out there and talk to them about it. And the lawyers tell you you can take a notebook in there and like write down stuff, but that's not very clear as to whether that's really true. When I was in there, they wouldn't let me take my notebook out into the hall, and they took it from me. And I've not seen it since. So after receiving immunity, if you plead the fifth and they give you immunity, a witness may also lose their ability to take notes or to even consult their attorney after a question. It's a pretty messed up situation. So that's kind of the quick and dirty rundown of how grand juries are abused or violate our constitutional rights. So I guess I'm just going to tell you more about my story. I was a nursing student at the community college, and one day I got out of class and I was walking to my car, and these two plainclothes guys approached me. One of them was an FBI agent. One of them was a Eugene police officer. And they wanted me to answer some questions. They told me I wasn't in trouble, but they wanted me to testify against the arsonist. They implied that if I didn't cooperate, I could be charged with something. They said something to the effect of, "We'd hate to see you sitting behind the defendant's desk." So kind of a veiled threat there. I told them I wasn't going to talk to them without a lawyer present. They gave me the card of the U.S. attorney and told me to have my lawyer call him. I didn't have a lawyer, so I called around and tried to figure out how I could get a lawyer. And I was told that all the federal public defenders in the Eugene area were all taken up pretty much with that case, the ELF case. So I was like, oh, you probably have to get a lawyer in Portland, I was told. And I did. I got a lawyer up here, a wonderful lawyer named Paul Loney. And he's a great guy, and he did a lot for me, and he didn't charge me anything for it. He deserves a lot of props. But before I figured out my lawyer situation, in less than a week, they came to my house and served me a subpoena to appear. And eventually, I got pushed back to May 18th, and that's when I went in. And the grand jury room is different than the courtroom. So I'm in the grand jury room, and they ask me my name and address and all that. And you're supposed to, the lawyers tell you to answer that. And then when they hop into the real questions, you say you're not going to cooperate. So I started out by taking the fifth, just in case they would just let me out on that. But they didn't. Then we walked over to the courtroom, and the judge gave me immunity. So then we walked back to the grand jury room, and they said, "Well, now you have to testify." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to testify because I feel like this whole process is violating my constitutional rights, like my First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. And so then they said, "Okay, well, we're going to go back to the court," and we had a contempt hearing, and I was found in civil contempt and was brought down to the holding chamber below the courtroom immediately, and they said, "Well, you have a few hours to reconsider your decision." But obviously I didn't do that, and they hauled me off to jail. And for most of the 6 months, I actually spent my time in Josephine County Jail, which is Grants Pass, even though I'm from Eugene. And my lawyer's from Portland. And that really sucked. My partner had to do a 5-hour round trip to come visit me, which kind of made that only once a week. And my lawyer would have had to make an 8-plus-hour round trip to come see me. So it was very challenging, especially not knowing how long I was going to be in jail. Grand juries are usually impaneled for 18 months, And luckily this one only had about 5 months left. And so I thought, okay, well, the longest I could be in was until September. But then come September, they decided to extend the grand jury another 6 months. And I would have been until March. I thought I was going to be until March when I was released. That whole global agreement went through, and nothing happened. They called up my lawyer immediately and said, so we still want your client to testify. And I was really depressed, and I thought I was going to be until March, but then they let me out a week later. Through this whole thing, I lost my spot in nursing school. I lost my job. My grandfather died, and I was unable to attend his funeral. And, I was just generally isolated from my friends and my partner and my lawyer, and it really sucked. But the support I got was amazing. People in Oregon and around the country writing me letters, the free legal representation, the people doing fundraisers and media outreach and putting events together like this, letting my partner borrow their car when our car broke down. People came over and did yard work in my house and donated firewood and all this stuff. So it was just amazing. People really came together, and there was a lot of solidarity, and that is something I think we should all be really proud of. Because, it sucks to be in jail, but I don't know if I could have done it without all that support. And that's really a statement from radical communities saying, fuck you, your campaign of harassment and intimidation isn't dividing this community. So I'd just like to thank everybody who played even the smallest role in any kind of support. It was important, not only for me, but for everyone. Like I was just saying, I think it was important for everyone to make that statement. Not just to lift my spirits, but to so that we could all experience that solidarity. Not only to help my partner pay our bills, but but for everyone's own sense of strength in the face of government repression. So that you'd know that if you were in my shoes, we'd have your back. Perhaps it was partly a lack of faith in the support of the radical communities that contributed to people breaking under the threat of life sentences and becoming informants. And that's really sad, because the support was there. So thank you so much. I also just wanted to say about writing prisoners. Before I went to jail, I didn't write very many prisoners because I didn't think I had anything interesting to say. And I found that anything is interesting when you're in jail. Really, anything. So if you've ever felt like that, or if you've been afraid, you didn't want to associate your name or anything like that, there's ways around these things, and I just encourage you to write. You can make up a fake name and address or something like that. You can give a letter to somebody else who's not afraid about putting their name on the envelope. And it doesn't matter what you write about. In fact, sometimes it's better just not to ask a bunch of questions. Just write a story. You don't have to apologize for having nothing to say and just telling a story, because that's really interesting when you're in jail. A hike, something fun you did with your day, something beautiful you saw, even a work project. It's all interesting when you're in the concrete box. So I encourage you to write letters and keep up the solidarity. And thanks.
Awesome. Thanks for staying strong. Hey, I'm Esther. I'm with Ever Heart Press, and I just wanted to say a couple things to try and help us remember where we're at here as human beings. So the current consensus in the scientific community is that most observable warming of the planet in the last 50 years is a result of human activity, like the burning of fossil fuels and land clearing. So I recently read this article in the New York Times, and it was about polar bears drowning because in the Arctic, the ice is melting, and so they have to swim much greater distances in order to reach food sources. And so they get exhausted, and they get hypothermia, and they drown. Human beings aren't faring much better up there either. The Inuit women are actually forced with this really horrible conundrum. Health officials have told them that they need to stop breastfeeding their babies because there's so many PCBs and mercury and other toxins in their bodies that it's actually dangerous for them to breastfeed. So it's a pretty harsh picture. So just before the time the Operation Backfire indictments were handed down, there were a lot of headlines in the newspapers about global warming. And scientists were introducing this new concept, and that was the concept of the tipping point. The idea is that the sun's rays come and they hit the ice, and they bounce back into space. And so that energy goes back out into space. But as the ice is melting, the sun's rays come down, and they hit water, and it warms up. And so it's this ever-increasing gain in temperature. So the Earth is not only warming, it's warming at an ever-increasing pace. And they're not sure if we're beyond the point of where it is reversible. So that's the concept of the tipping point. It might not be reversible. So then these eco-terror indictments are handed down, and the state has something to say. The state says, these people are terrorists because they burn things down because they're concerned about the environment. They didn't burn things down because they wanted to get insurance money or because they were pissed off at their ex-wife. They burned things down because they were concerned about the environment. So what the government wants to do is they want to add this terrorism enhancement, which would put an additional 20 years on their sentences. So people who are already facing 5-year sentences or 8-year sentences, if they get this terrorism enhancement, instead they'll be in for 25 years or 28 years. Why? Because of the idea behind the crime. The health of the planet and the animals and the humans that live here is more important than profit, than property, than industry, than my couch being fire retardant. The health of the Earth's ecosystems, the health of the forests, the air that we breathe, the water that we drink is important. And this health is seriously threatened by human activity. Scientists, environmentalists, everyday people, anyone who's been paying attention, we all know this. We've known this for a really long time. And it's like we're dealing with a system where we have very little recourse. People have written letters. People have locked themselves to bulldozers. People have held signs. People have yelled in the streets. People have written articulate and coherent and really lucid articles that have been published in mainstream magazines and newspapers. And yet it's getting worse, year after year. It gets worse and worse and worse. It's not getting any better. Change is not being made. It's getting worse every year. So I'm not here to talk about tactics or to make any judgments. What matters is this. The state is sending a message, and the message is this. If you commit a crime because you're concerned about the environment and the animals and the humans, then you will be locked up for a long, long time. This is a threat to anyone who cares about old-growth forests, clean air, polar bears, or the continuation of our species. This is part of an ongoing effort to silence those who speak out. We must not allow ourselves to be silenced. It is imperative that we be here for these people as they bear the brunt of state repression. We have to support them now. We have to support them through their sentencing. We have to support them when they're in jail. That means we have to write letters to them, we need to raise money for them, and we need to be there for them when they get out of prison. We cannot forget these people. These guys are going to jail for us. They're going to jail for the health of our planet, for the health of our children, so that we can breathe clean air and have clean water. They're in there for us. We need to be out there for them. We will not be silenced.
Quick announcement. Jeff mentioned writing prisoners. There's a whole lot of information and addresses on the tables over there for letter writing supplies. And stick around. Tandem Nation's coming up next. Drunken Boat and Oxomica are playing, and we're going to have an update on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. So, yeah, stay around.